This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's abstract, and so a majority of people are not going to really get what the problem is right away, and there's a lot of learning that needs to take place. And so what you need is a vocal minority of people who just say no to whatever. No to oil, no to coal, no to, and you just keep saying no and no and no, and don't bother making an argument, you just get out there and vote. That's what's going to move the needle in terms of environmental policy.
From time to time, so-called moderate Democratic legislators cross party lines to work with Republicans. Do you ever wonder if voters from red states appreciate those gestures? More importantly, what kind of impact do these collaborations and compromises end up making in the crafting of policy? This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a deep dive into the political pool with John Storr, a columnist with the Washington Monthly and New Haven Register. Storr explores the heterogeneity of the Democratic Party and how the Republican Party contrasts with that, asserts that the Trump administration's dereliction of duty in Puerto Rico is yet another impeachable offense, and talks about whether it's important for politicians to avoid the obstructionist label. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by John Storr. He's a contributing writer at the Washington Monthly and a columnist for the New Haven Register. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece on May 17th entitled, "The Democrats Don't Need Purity." Maybe you can kind of summarize the thesis of this and how it relates to the upcoming election, the midterms, and how it affects people who care about the environment.
Sure, yeah. Anybody who cares about the environment or social justice really has to keep in mind the fundamental differences between the parties. Basically, when you keep these differences in mind, a lot of stuff starts to make sense, and you can start to see through a lot of the nonsense that passes for analysis when it comes to the two parties. So I'll start with the Republicans. The Republicans are really top-down. They're very hierarchical, and they're very homogenous. They're homogenous economically, they're homogenous racially, religiously, and geographically. They're not in big cities. And they're very authoritarian, too. So when the top people say something, usually the bottom people respond. They may grumble and stuff, but they'll eventually get in line. The structure of the party means that they're fairly weak, and they cannot, and they're weak and somewhat brittle. They're not elastic enough to handle innovation or even dissent very well, especially when that dissent is funded by billions of dollars coming from billionaires who have agendas of their own, and they want to push those agendas through the party. When billionaires come calling, usually the Republicans listen. And we saw this explicitly illustrated for us when they passed a tax cut that virtually nobody said was a good idea. The businesses said, don't do it. We're only going to keep the money. We're not investing it. And yet the Republicans went ahead and did it anyway under the false pretense that it would juice the economy. And it certainly hasn't happened. So that's the Republicans. And on the other side, you have the Democrats. And the Democrats are really very different. They're very diverse. They constitute little groups, interest groups, you know, and these interest groups are, you know, based on race and religion and all the kinds of things that people identify themselves with. And because they're so diverse, they tend to be fairly elastic and can handle dissent and innovation from the bottom. But because they're also, because they are heterogeneous, they also can find it difficult to send a clear, coherent message. And everybody complains about the Democrats not being good with their messages, but that's not necessarily a fair description, because they're really comparing it to the Republicans, who are very good at sending a message, and they're very good. Why? Because they are top-down and hierarchical and can get on the same page all at the same time. Democrats are different. One is like herding sheep, and you can get them all in a line and get them going just fine. The other is more like herding cats.
So let's take that analysis and then look at the creamy center of both parties, and then their wings, the right wing and the left wing of the Republican Democratic Party, respectively, if you can.
Yeah, the creamy center. The word center is something I think listeners should keep in mind, too. It does exist, but then again, it doesn't really exist. It does exist within the particular context with particular people talking about particular policies. Like, eventually people will find a way to agree. But the whole media construction of center is very problematic, and it probably doesn't really exist. It's a media construction. You have to be careful about what they mean when they say middle. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you talking about deal making? That's good. You know, if people can make deals, well, who cares about what the middle is, you know? If they're talking about where is the middle and how are the Democrats going to pivot to the Trump voters and that kind of thing, well, that may or may not be necessary. So let me go back to the particular people in a particular place. In a particular place like, say, West Virginia or Indiana, where a guy like John Donnelly, he's in Indiana, and Joe Manchin, he's in West Virginia, these are Democrats. They know their constituencies. They know that, you know, people are going to, they like, take Joe Manchin because I know him better. He's been there forever. His family name has been forever in the newspapers of West Virginia. People know him. He's a name. He's a Democrat, but he's also not the kind of Democrat, you know, that people in Virginia imagine exists in places like San Francisco and New York. So he knows these people, and he's going to speak to them in the way he knows how to speak to them. That may appear to us here on the coast like he's speaking to the middle, but he's really just speaking the language that works there, you know. And he's just going to make decisions that are good for him there. And because the Democratic Party is so diverse, they're really going to let him just do whatever he needs to do. Like Nancy Pelosi said a couple of months ago, just win. I mean, that's all. If whatever it takes, win. And that's partly why I say in that piece, you know, purity be damned. You just got to do what's practically necessary to win. And then with winning, you can talk about, you know, what policies are the best policies.
Yes, but when we look at the Republicans, they actually do have more purity tests than the Democrats, and they seem to be winning.
Yeah, and that's because they're homogenous. They are becoming more homogenous. As I say, you have the Koch brothers billionaires who really led the purge of the Republican Party beginning around 2010. And, you know, getting rid of anybody who was willing to compromise, et cetera, et cetera. That is actually moving. There's some indicators that the Koch brothers are pulling back as if they are realizing what they've done. Like they've created, they sowed the fields for Trump. And they're like, oh my God, this guy is a madman. You know, he's giving us a tax break. We like that. You know, he's cutting regulations. We like that. But the Koch brothers are not insane, you know, whereas the Trump, you know, he is. And the people who tend to like him tend to be fairly decoupled from reality. The Koch brothers are not, you know, no matter how you think of the Koch brothers, I mean, I don't like their politics at all, but they do believe that they are citizens of the United States and they have loyalty to this country.
Sure.
You know, they really do. And it's not power above all for them. Whereas it is for Trump, it's about power. It's about him, right?
I think the framing of our discussion is important. When we talk about purity, that sounds like kind of a negative implication that Democrats don't need purity. But what if we reframe that? Do Democrats need a coherent message? And I think I think parsing that language is important, because I think what you're talking about is Republicans being homogeneous. but they also have a coherent message. But there are a lot more Democrats in this country than Republicans, and just those are the numbers. So maybe the Democrats do need a more coherent message, and maybe that means purity. Maybe somebody like Joe Manchin voting against the party because he's trying to appeal to his West Virginia constituents is actually weakening the Democrats' message. Maybe a Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota voting for Gina Haspel to be confirmed is actually hurting the party more than helping her reelection campaign. That's what I believe, at least. I think that if Democrats are more united in what they believe, that'll ultimately get more people out to vote. And if more people vote, Democrats win.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds really persuasive, but I just don't see how. And that thesis does mesh with some evidence, but then there's other evidence that frustrates the thesis.
Such as?
For the fact that the Democrats probably will never be completely united. Because it's like herding cats. Mm-hmm. You know, they are, it's really a heterogeneous bunch. And they probably won't ever agree on some things. What they do agree on is larger contours, right? The baseline agreement is really like, you know, beat the Republicans. That's the baseline agreement. And then after that, it's like, well, some things interest us and some things don't. Back to the other point about a clearer message leading to more turnout. I don't know about that either. I think when you have a midterm, what really moves the needle is really animated minorities, not racial minorities, but small groups versus the majority, really animated minorities of people getting out and voting and making something happen and focusing on one particular issue. That gets things going. The thing about environmental concerns is that it is its own problem politically. It's abstract, and so a majority of people are not going to really get what the problem is right away. And there's a lot of learning that needs to take place. And so what you need is a vocal minority of people who just say no to whatever. No to oil, no to coal, no to, and they just keep saying no and no and no, and don't bother making an argument, you just get out there and vote. That's what's going to move the needle in terms of environmental policy.
I know a guy that's got a lot to lose. He's a pretty nice fella, kinda confused. Got muscles in his head, ain't never been used. Thinks he owns half of this town. Starts drinking heavy, gets a big red nose. Beats his old lady with a rubber hose. Then he takes her out to dinner, buys her new clothes. That's the way that the world goes round. That's the way that the world goes round. You're up one day, the next you're down, it's a happening to water. You think you're gonna drown. That's the way that the world goes round.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist John Storr. John, I agree with you that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has been successful when it clings to a simpler message. I'm thinking of Bill McKibben leading the charge to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. It wasn't the most important environmental issue in the world, but it resonated with people, mm-hmm. and it mobilized people in the streets in a way that we don't see a lot when it comes to environmental issues. Similarly with Bernie Sanders. If you followed the election very closely, he sounded like a broken record. But if you were just going to a rally for the first time and heard him for the first time, it probably excited you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we agree on this. I'm not sure what we're agreeing on is that general premise that the senators in swing states are making the right calculations in, quote unquote, appealing to their constituents by voting with Republicans. When I think about low information voters who would vote for Donald Trump, I have a lot of trouble thinking that they will understand that their senator confirmed the new CIA head that was picked by Donald Trump, so they're going to vote for her. I just think that when we're talking about Democrats don't need a purity test, that's fair enough. It's a very diverse party, but they should at least vote in a united manner if they want to win. If we're talking about just win, baby, like Nancy Pelosi saying, you have to put on as good a front as the other party, and we're in a particularly bifurcated era right now where you have to stand strong. We're not in the era of Tip O'Neill making deals with Ronald Reagan.
No, you're not. I mean, all of that's true, and I don't know if I have a solution, who am I? But what I can say is that Democrats are, they really are at a disadvantage, and I don't mean just because they're out of power right now. I mean, they're really structurally at a disadvantage. You know, the whole country is set up to the advantage of the Republicans. You know, small states have just as many votes in the Senate as large states. The Republicans have more money. They have more of backing from the energy sector, you know, and so that means there's more people making a living wage in coal companies. Well, coal's a bad example, but you get the
natural
idea.
Natural gas.
You know, the natural gas. Generally, the people, America is a conservative place if you keep in mind that people are getting more liberal. Like, historic, the norm really is conservatism, racism, bigotry, right? And anything deviant from that is kind of like, wow, that's great. You know, it's moving on. So to go back to the Gina Haspel nomination and, John Donnelly and Manchin and Heitkamp voting for her, bear in mind that, you know, most people most of the time have no idea what's going on in politics because they have something better to do. Only you and me and the people who care about these things enough to dedicate our days to it know, you know, her record of being involved in torture and how heinous that is, and that she really should be, if justice really existed, she'd be in a criminal court facing charges right now. But most people don't know that because they don't know she was involved in it. What they do know is that the president appointed somebody, and it's up to the Senate to okay her. It's that simple. And if the Democrats keep saying no, 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 then they'll look like they're obstructing, which is good for lots of Democrats, but bad for people like Manchin and Heitkamp and Donnelly, who are like walking a razor's edge. You know, they're like, I just got to win, etc. Now, let me add to that that Heitkamp and those guys, they wouldn't matter if the Democrats could win big majorities in the Senate, but that's not going to happen because the Republicans have a structural advantage. See what I mean?
I understand that, but I guess the very premise that you're making there and the obstructionist argument is a perfect example of, I think, the disconnect within the party. Somehow, Democrats feel more vulnerable when called an obstructionist than Republicans. Republicans were the party of no for 8 years, and yet in 2016, they came in and swept both houses of Congress and the White House. Now Democrats are being called obstructionists, even though they don't control the reins of power by, you know, the White right. House. And they seem to be sensitive to that. I don't think they should be.
Well, I think your premise is that, you know, if it works for the Republicans, it should work for the Democrats, right?
Well, when we're talking about just win, can't we look to that as a template possibly?
No, because the two parties are different. They really are. The Democrats they're going to win over some people by sticking to their guns and sticking it to the president. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But then they're going to lose some people too. And keep in mind that the people that the Democrats right now are working those margins like hell. You know, that's where the winning and losing takes place. You know, those margins.
Talk about those margins a little more if you can. Explain.
Sure. The margins are you know, what territory is ripe for taking, right? And the territory right now is educated white people who live in the suburbs of major cities around the country, places that the Democrats sometimes have, sometimes don't. Usually it's these are well-to-do folks who would normally vote for Republican, but they just can't stand Trump, right? That's the lowest of low-hanging fruit right now. That they must and are focusing on right now for the midterm. Later, they'll have to do a different strategy. I really agree with those people who are just coming off as plain Janes and just saying, look, I'm a normal person. Now compare me to Trump. You make the choice. You know, you don't need purity in a context like that.
And on the flip side, you have the Republicans making their case for the midterms, saying you don't want Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House again.
Yeah.
And that will mean that the president's going to be impeached. That's supposed to be a winning argument. Is it in your view?
No, I don't think it's going to work, because if the Democrats had a president who was threatening to get impeached, I think Democrats would come out for their guy. But Republicans aren't going to do that because they're different. They come out when they hate something. You see what I mean?
That's why they're trying to put up Nancy Pelosi as the boogeyman there, right?
Yeah, no, but she's just, nobody knows who Nancy Pelosi is. They
right.
assume that, really, you're Joe Schmo Republican. He's like, all he knows about Nancy Pelosi is...
She's from San Francisco.
Pretty much nothing. She's from San Francisco. I mean, they don't know. So, like I said, most people most of the time don't have something better to do than pay attention to politics. And they might get a few people out there who are like, good God, Nancy Pelosi, I better get out and vote for Trump. But that's not the same as hate Hillary, vote for Trump. You know, that's a different message. And hating something is what got, when a Democrat was in power, when Obama was in power, it was so easy to get turnout, you know, boom, it was all, Republicans hardly had to do anything. You know, once those primaries were set, once they had that in line, they were like, but fine, we can defeat the Democrats because the Democrats are carrying Obama. Well, now it's time for payback. It's going to happen again this time, probably. I mean, it's still going to... Again, the Republicans have these gerrymandered advantages. Gerrymandering mean districting. And it's still a big if, but if the Democrats take the House, it's probably not going to be by a wide margin. It's going to be razor thin. So even then, you know, talk of impeachment's going to be... You know, it's not a slam dunk. It'll be a debate.
There's nothing in the streets. Looks any different to me. The slogans are replaced by the by. The party. Change all around. Pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray. We don't get fooled again.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist John Storr. So, John, speaking of impeachment, you penned a piece recently entitled 4,645 Reasons to Impeach Trump. This is referring, of course, to the death toll in Puerto Rico as a result of the hurricane there. We're going to be seeing more hurricanes of this magnitude, according to all the science. So how will Americans react when they see a president offering nothing but braggadocio and indifference to a crisis like this? Will this really result in just razor-thin margins still in the House and the Senate? Are we able to kind of compartmentalize our politics so much that it's purely local? Or can Donald Trump be kind of a specter over voters in November? First, why don't you summarize your piece? Yeah.
Well, the 4,600 people died in Puerto Rico, according to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and that's about 70 times more than the official death toll, which was 64, I believe. In my piece, what I do is I compare obstruction of justice with the president's duty to protect the citizenry. During the Watergate hearings of 1974, the Judiciary Committee in the House drafted four articles of impeachment, and one of those articles was about obstruction and how the president at the time obstructed justice, which was an injury to the people of the United States. And then the word injury is very important to me in this piece, because then I say, if a president can inflict a kind of injury worthy of being impeached, an injury meaning violating the rule of law, what about a real injury? What about 4,600 dead Americans? In my piece, I say that I doubt there would be any impeachment for these crimes. I just really don't think there would be, but there should be. And when a president fails to protect the citizenry, when the central duty of any government is to defend life, liberty, our government, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and fails at that, I think that's impeachable. I really do. I don't think it'll happen. I think obstruction of justice will be the focus of whatever happens after November. But 4,600 people, that's more than who died after Hurricane Katrina. That's more than all the people who died during the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. I mean, this is a major stain on our history, and yet it's just going to blow right by. And I failed to mention that these deaths were directly attributable, according to the study, to government's indifference. That's the key link here, is that Trump is culpable because basically the federal government said, we're done. We're done here. When in fact they were not done. They were just getting started. And that's where the lack of accountability comes into play.
And you make a great point that impeachment is a political process, not a legal one. And so this should have just as much leverage in terms of an impeachable offense as obstructing justice and what the Mueller investigation is pursuing.
I mean, it cuts both ways. When I say it's a political process and not a legal one, what I mean in terms of Hurricane Maria and 4,600 dead, it's a political process, and therefore that's the problem, because a lot of people don't know Puerto Ricans are Americans. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And if you have a lot of people, and I would say a majority, that's a guess, obviously, but I would guess a majority of Americans don't know Puerto Rico is full of American citizens. And if they don't know, you're not going to build up a lot of political momentum for impeaching anybody about 4,600 people dying. That's the fundamental problem right there. It's obviously a moral tragedy. You know, morally, this is unconscionable. I mean, just it's ridiculous. I mean, we've been better to foreign countries and foreign citizens than we have been to our own. But I think that's the fundamental problem right there, and that's why I say, if and whenever we get to talking about actual impeachment, it will be about obstruction of justice and not these 4,600 dead people.
John Storr, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Budos Band, John Prine, and Pete Townsend. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.